How are we all doing? Good. We're in Daniel 7. Okay. In the beginning of Daniel chapter 7, we're introduced to four beasts. The first three kind of creatures that we're used to. Lions, tigers, and bears. Oh my. Well, there's not a tiger, but you get the point. And then the fourth one, dreadful and terrifying. Not really described as an animal, just pretty scary looking creature. These represent the same four world kingdoms that were introduced in Daniel chapter 2. Then, what's a little bit different is in Daniel chapter 2, there's 10 toes. And in Daniel chapter 7, there's 10 horns. And then there's a special emphasis in verse 8 on one particular horn that comes up, breaks off the three that are before it, okay? Kind of prides itself and then starts uttering boastful things against God, okay? Verses 9 through 12, the Ancient of Days judges that beast and the horn, okay? But an extension of life is granted to them. Then in verses 13 and 14, which we spent almost three or four classes on, okay, is Jesus being presented before the Ancient of Days at his ascension, at what Hebrews would call the consummation of the ages, and he received glory, dominion, and a kingdom. So what we've learned up to this point, as we zoom out in chapter 7 that chapter 2 doesn't necessarily show us, is chapter 7 is special emphasis on the dominion being stripped from the earthly kingdoms and being transferred to Jesus. In Daniel chapter 2, we see the destruction of those kingdoms. The statue is crushed by the rock and turns into chaff that blows away on the summer threshing floor, okay? But the emphasis is in Daniel chapter 2 is the establishment of Jesus' kingdom and that it would cover the entire earth. Okay, here in chapter 7, we see dominion being taken from the earthly rulers and being given to Jesus. Okay, he is seated on the throne of heaven, far above all other rule and authority, the scriptures say. So that's the fulfillment of that. verse 15 says, as for me, Daniel, my spirit was distressed within me, and the visions in my mind kept alarming me. You have to understand that it wasn't necessarily a terrible vision. It wasn't bad news for Daniel. It wasn't bad news for Judah. A lot of it's actually good news, that those that would utter boasts against God would be judged, and then the rightful king would receive the kingdom, and many thousands upon thousands will be attending him. So it's not that it was like bad news that he's troubled. It's just that there's a lot going on. And it's a lot to process. Very intense. In verse 16, he says, I approached one of those who were standing by. That had been an angel. And began asking him the exact meaning of all this. So he told me and made known to me the interpretation of these things. These great beasts, which are four in number, are four kings who will arise from the earth. But the saints of the highest one will receive the kingdom and possess the kingdom forever for all ages to come. So that's as far as we've got. Okay. Now, as the angel is explaining the interpretation of the vision, we can confirm that those four beasts do indeed represent four world kingdoms. We can see that that matches Daniel 2, and then the interpretation of the vision is confirmed. The other thing that we noticed last week, which was really cool, in verse 18, the saints of the highest one will receive the kingdom. Now, when we go back to verses 13 and 14, the Son of Man received the kingdom. And then in the interpretation of the vision, the saints received the kingdom. So, really cool. No need to confuse yourselves. The answer is always just yes. Yeah. Well, who received the kingdom? Was it Jesus or was it the church? Okay. Yes. That is how tightly connected Jesus is to his church. Kevin's absolutely correct when he says when you look in the Old Testament and you see prophecies of Jesus, the church is never far behind. And as you get further and further through the Old Testament, and the prophecies start to narrow down and get more and more specific, that's when the church and Jesus are even closer. This being a great example of that. Okay, so let's pick up in verse 19, read through the end of the chapter, and let's see how much of this we can bite off today. I will give you a warning. You can't get lost in the sauce, all right? I do not believe that you could 100% nail down every character that's being introduced here. A lot of this stuff is symbolic, so I'm not going to take that position before you. I will give you my take on how this stuff fits as I bring in the other New Testament scriptures to back it up. Verse 19, then I desired to know the exact meaning of the fourth beast, which was different from all the others. Exceedingly dreadful, its teeth of iron, its claws of bronze, and which devoured, crushed, and trampled down the remainder with its feet. The meaning of the 10 horns that were on its head, and the other horn which came up, and before which 3 of them fell, namely the horn which eyes had mouth uttering great boasts, and which are larger in appearance than its associates. I kept looking, and that horn was waging war with the saints, and overpowering them, until the Ancient of Days came, and judgment was passed in favor of the saints of the Highest One, and the time arrived when the saints took possession of the kingdom. Thus he said, the fourth beast will be a fourth kingdom on the earth, which will be different from all the other kingdoms, and will devour the whole earth and tread it down and crush it. As for the 10 horns out of the kingdom, 10 kings will arise, and another will arise after them, and he will be different from the previous ones and will subdue 3 kings. He will speak out against the Most High and wear down the saints of the Highest One, and he will intend to make alterations in times and in law, and they will be given into his hand for a time, times, and half a time. But the court will sit for judgment, and his dominion will be taken away, annihilated, and destroyed forever. Then the sovereignty, the dominion, and the greatness of all the kingdoms and of the whole heaven will be given to the people, the saints of the Highest One. His kingdom will be an everlasting kingdom, and dominions will serve and obey him. At this point, the revelation ended. As for me, Daniel, my thoughts were greatly alarming me, and my face grew pale, and I kept the matter to myself. Okay. So, the angel says that the beast represents 4 kings, and then the saints of the Highest One receive the kingdom. In verse 19, he's like, well, I want to know more about this fourth beast. Now, from just the introduction to the fourth beast, even its physical description, we can see that it's different than the other 3. I've already made that point in the beginning of class. So he says it's different. It was dreadful. And then he mentions in verse 19 these specifics. He says it has iron teeth, claws of bronze, which devour, crush, and trample down the remainder with its feet. Okay? That's important because that continues to confirm for us that this beast represents what? Gwyneth. Babylon, Persia, Greece, Rome. Okay, you guys are still on Thanksgiving break, so I should have given you an easier one. Okay, now why does that language, teeth of iron, crush and trampling down the remainder with its feet, why does that confirm for us that this is referring to Rome? Say there's 2 things here that are pretty... Iron. So in Daniel 2, Rome is introduced as iron, correct? And then one more detail. No bronze... Yeah, so it doesn't say clay here, right? So what's here that confirms for us the iron would be the connection? The other part that actually confirms for us is that it will crush and trample down the remainder with its feet. Because that is the exact same language in Daniel chapter 2. Okay, we'll actually go ahead and go back there because I'm getting blank stares. Verse 40, Daniel chapter 2, verse 40. It says, then there will be a fourth kingdom. So this is the introduction of the fourth kingdom of iron. It says, there will be a fourth kingdom, strong as iron, inasmuch as iron crushes and shatters all things. So like iron that breaks into pieces, it will crush and break all these into pieces. It's talking about the first three. So when Rome's introduced in Daniel chapter 2, okay, it's given the description as being iron and strong and crushing what came before it. In Daniel chapter 7, verse 19, it's introduced as iron through its teeth. And then at the end of verse 19, it says it tramples down the remainder with its feet. Okay, that's referring to the first three beasts. Okay, so that's similar there. That's how we know this is Rome. Okay, now, next point to lay a foundation, and then we'll start to work through this. In verse 21, we see a horn waging war with the holy ones, that's the saints, and that term saints is used in the New Testament to address the church. We've already confirmed that this is the church receiving the kingdom, but this again helps confirm us with this language. So the horn is waging war with the church until the Ancient of Days came and judgment was passed in favor of the saints. I'm going to try and confuse you, and then I'll try to unconfuse you. Okay? You can't look at this chronologically because it just doesn't happen that way. And large sections of this are symbolic. Okay? So here's what's happening. You have Babylon, Persia, Greece, and Rome, right? Then in verse 12, the Ancient of Days is presented, and he judges those four kingdoms. Have you guys followed that up to this point in this class? Okay. Is the church around yet? I mean, we're talking about, 700 BC, 500 BC. Okay, Jesus has not come. The Spirit has not yet been given, right? So you've got these four creatures which represent kingdoms that are 700 BC, 500 BC. Okay? And then they're judged by the Ancient of Days. Then we get to verses 21 and 22, and we see the horn warring with the saints, and then the Ancient of Days judges. So if a horn is judging saints, this is going to be when the church is around, yes? So now we've gone from 500 BC all the way to 30 AD, right? And now the horn's waging war with saints in 30 AD while the New Testament's being written, and then the Ancient of Days judges them. Well, I thought the Ancient of Days already judged them. Okay, he did. Now here's what you got to see. Verse 22. Until the Ancient of Days came. The Bible never refers to God in heaven in judgment as coming. He's already there. Jesus is the one who comes. Almost always. Now, you guys go check that out on your own. But this picture here of judgment coming by the Ancient of Days. Guys, Jesus says, okay, I did not come to judge the world when he was on earth. Right? He says, there is one who judges the world, the word which I have spoken is what will judge on the last day. Right? Well, who's the word? In that same book, in the Gospel of John, that's why it's so important that Jesus is introduced as the word. Right? Now you get to, let's say 2 Thessalonians. Who's coming? On the clouds, with the angels, in judgment. So we're still waiting for that judgment to come, right? So who's coming in judgment? Jesus. So in verse 22, when it says the Ancient of Days comes, and he's going to pass judgment in favor of the saints, that's referring to Jesus. Now, did that confuse you? There are two judgments. One's a foreshadow. It's done physically. The other one, and then when Rome is judged in the Old Testament, that transference of dominion is given to Jesus, isn't it? When he conquers death. Then from there, he establishes the church, and then church is going to be at war with that horn for a time, times, and half a time, which is the church age. And then Jesus comes in final judgment. Okay? So back to Daniel 7, what I just, hopefully that makes sense. You know, maybe you didn't even notice it, but that confused me for a little bit trying to figure out what's going on here. What I want you to see, at least for right now, is in verse 22, when the Ancient of Days comes and judgment was passed, it just called Jesus the Ancient of Days. So Jesus is God. The Bible just said it. Again, I have no problem with it. Okay? The last, you know, I've got dozens of Bible studies, and the last one that was kind of really like a, I'm going to meet you to challenge your teachings kind of Bible study, the last time that happened, about 2 months ago. Well, I'll say the one serious one. You know, the point that he was making is Jesus is not God. Okay? And there's two reasons, you know, why he couldn't get over that hump, and, you know, no need to say, but look, the Bible clearly is putting the two as one. And in a section that's prophetic, and it's prophesying the consummation of the ages, I mean, this, you know, this isn't Jesus is going to ride a donkey to Jerusalem, okay? This is like, this is the foreshadowing and the pulling back of the curtain of the consummation of the ages, and it refers to Jesus as the Ancient of Days. I think that's cool. So, now we've got that established. We've got four earthly world kingdoms, Babylon, Persia, Greece, Rome. We know that Jesus came in the days of the Romans. Those earthly kingdoms are being represented by these creatures. When Jesus comes, God judges them, okay, and he takes their dominion and gives it to Jesus. And now Jesus sits on the throne, and all dominion and authority has been given to him, and everything's been laid at his feet, right? But do earthly kingdoms continue to rise and fall? Yes. So when the Ancient of Days judges in verse 12, he judges, you know, Babylon, Persia, and Greece, which were types, but he ultimately judges Rome, who is the culmination of all of those. The point I'm going to make today, I'm going to establish that Rome is the culmination of all those earthly powers. He judges them, he takes their dominion, he gives it to Jesus, but then grants them an extension of life. So he doesn't judge, you know, Persia and Greece and Rome and Babylon in the sense that he just, you know, wipes them off the map, like Kendall's saying. If we're going to try and look at this physically, then why are Egypt and Edom still inhabited? See, that's not what God's judgment was in Daniel. It wasn't a wiping off the map. It was a taking of dominion and going, here, Jesus, you are empowered. Okay? Mark, you got to give me one more minute, okay? Now, the next point of emphasis that's being made here is that the fourth beast was different than the others. Okay? That we have to make sense of. The fourth beast was different than the others. When this extension of life is granted to these world powers, do they continue on as, I gotta stop saying lions, tigers, and bears, you know, because that's how you're gonna remember it. Okay. Lions, leopards, and bears, oh my, you know. Lions, leopards, and lopsided bears, oh my. Did I say it wrong? Oh, okay. That's from the name of the, I just lost it, someone give it to me. The Wizard of Oz, yeah. I think we have the, by the way, this is a side note, okay? Okay. I think we have the villain wrong in that movie. I'm just saying. You know, you guys go check that out on your own. Yeah, this is the stuff that, you know, keeps me up at night. And I don't know what you guys do at night, but the Wicked Witch of the West, is she the bad guy really in that story? Because there's, you guys check it out, okay? So, well, you gotta think about this stuff, you know? Yeah. Okay. Lions, leopards, and lopsided bears, oh my. An extension of life is granted to them. Instead of being lions, leopards, and lopsided bears, their extension of life is communicated as a horn. This horn that just breaks off. So it's attached to that, right? The horn comes from those, but it is not those. And then it almost takes on human features in its appeal and boastfulness. You see that? What we see from the very beginning is in chapter 7, verse 19, I desired to know the exact meaning of the fourth beast. He was different. He was so different. Even in the earthly representation of those four, the fourth beast was different. It wasn't a lion, leopard, or bear. It was a dreadful beast. Iron teeth. Okay, this scary looking thing. Even in its physical form, God's communicating to us that Rome would be different from its predecessors. Okay? In what ways was Rome very different from the three kingdoms that came before it? I want you to think about that. Now, I wrote something down I want to read to us. In Babel, Nimrod the revolter, if you go check out that Hebrew, okay, calls him the hunter, you know. He doesn't deserve the title, okay? So he's Nimrod the revolter, okay? Establishes Babel, the first kingdom in Genesis. Babylon, being the first world power, becomes the first representation of kingdoms opposed to God. In Daniel chapter 2. Because when you read Daniel 2, Daniel interprets the dream and he says, "You, King of Kings, are the head of all kings to whom God has given dominion." You remember that? Let's see how this goes. Here's your dominion, Nebi. And what does mankind do with it? They make themselves God. And then what does the value of the statue represent? It goes from gold to slightly less valuable silver to slightly less valuable bronze to slightly less valuable iron. Now, iron, each of these has a purpose, but value-wise, I mean, you guys got any iron earrings in today? Hopefully you guys don't have earrings in, you know. Yeah. Any iron earrings? Oh, you probably got gold. You know, and then if you like the shine, you know, maybe some silver. But do you see how the thing's deteriorating in value? Okay? That's because God gave the head of gold dominion. And then it just self-destructs, deteriorates as man continues to take that dominion and make himself God, and then they rule their kingdom, saying they're God, right? And then what does God do? He strikes it with a rock and then takes the dominion back and gives it to Jesus. That's Daniel chapter 7. Does this make sense now? Okay. So what's happening then is Rome being the fourth kingdom in both of these visions, where judgment is introduced, is the one who consummated the evil. What's the evil? Mankind taking God's dominion and making itself God. Rome is the consummation of that evil. It is all the other kingdoms bad coming down into one. Okay. We have deteriorated to the point of iron. Now it's time to judge it and take its dominion. Now that doesn't surprise you, because you leave mankind alone long enough and they're going to fully deteriorate to where God's got to flood the whole thing. You see how that keeps happening over and over again? So, I want you guys to go to 1 Peter. So somehow you got to make sense of everything I just said and give me an example how Rome was very different from its predecessors, the first three kingdoms. Now, I always found this interesting. First Peter chapter 5, Verse 12. Through Silvanus, our faithful brother, for so I regard him, I have written to you briefly, exhorting and testifying that this is the true grace of God. Stand firm in it. She who is in Babylon, chosen together with you, sends you greetings. And so does my son Mark. You ever noticed that before? So Peter writes this to the church dispersed, right? And he says, yep, Silvanus, through him, I've written to you. I've written. And those who are with me send greetings. And he says he's where? Says he's in Babylon. Yeah, those of us, as he's writing this, okay, us, she who is in Babylon, okay, sends you greetings. Does Babylon exist when this is being written? Not physically. Babylon's been judged, wiped off. If Babylon was on a map, Kendall, it does get to get wiped off, doesn't it? Because Babylon got wiped out. Okay? So, where does Paul likely write, or Peter, sorry, whew, thanks for saving me there. Where does Peter likely write this from physically? Rome. And he just called Rome Babylon. Because Rome is the consummation of the evil. That started, Nebi, here's your dominion. You know, don't mess it up. And he's already got to turn him into a dog. Because the dominion already goes to his head, doesn't it? And then it just continues through Persia and the Medes and the Greeks and the Romans to where now they are God. Serve me, my subjects. I am God. And that's what they did with God's dominion. So God took it from them and gave it to Jesus. Now that part you guys get. What I'm showing you is Rome is very different from the first three because it is the consummation of that evil. It is like all those kingdoms together in one where like the whole system was just anti-God. Every component of it was idolatry. Every component of it was immorality. Okay, it is the consummation of the evil. Now, from a, let's say, physical description, not like geographically, although that's true as well, what made Rome really different from the first three nations that came before it? And here's how we got to think about this. Okay, let's think about it this way. If you are... Oops. Let's say you are this lopsided bear, right? You're Persia. And you've got three ribs in your mouth. So you're this lopsided bear, you're Persia, and you've got three ribs inside your mouth. What do those ribs represent? Kingdoms. Now, why are those kingdoms in the mouth of the bear? Because he conquered them. Probably Babylon, Egypt, can pretty sure nail down. And then I would also say Lydia. Three kingdoms. Okay? So, if you're Persia and you want to conquer another kingdom, you devour it. Does that make sense? Okay. You are Greece, and you want to conquer another kingdom, what do? You devour it. Now, the first king of Greece was Alexander the Great. Ever heard of a city called Alexandria? I think there's an Alexandria on every continent except Antarctica. And if you were to go home today and do your Google research, how many Alexandrias are you going to find across the globe? I mean, it's one of the more commonly named cities in the world. Why? Because of Alexander the Great. So, ever heard of the Hellenistic Jews? What made, you know, why do we have to learn all this stuff? You know, we got to figure out, okay, now here's another one, you know, got to call Kevin. What does this mean, the Hellenized Jews? And Kevin say, oh, those are just Jews who, what? Had Greek culture. They primarily spoke Greek, and they had Greek customs. Now, why on earth is that true? Because they weren't in Jerusalem. They are in Macedonia, southern Asia, okay? So you got Jews who have dispersed, you know, after the Babylonian captivity. Too much information, sorry. You've got Jews who have dispersed into regions not in Judah. Can you guys see his excellent Mediterranean Sea here? Right? And then this is Egypt. Or I'm sorry, this is Israel. So the Jews who are coming back from the Babylonian captivity, some of them dispersed up here. Now what's up here? Greek culture, man. Because they were the ones who came before the Romans, and the remnant of their empire was still there. So they had Greek culture, Greek food, Greek customs. So people who lived in those areas had those same customs. Now they're coming into Jerusalem where, you know, Hebrew is thought to be the holy language, and, you know, it's the language of our God, and, you know, we have our own customs, and they kind of were not really sure what to do with these outsider Jews, so they were neglecting them. Okay? The point that I'm trying to make here is, if in the Old Testament, if you are a bear, a lion, a leopard, and you want to devour another kingdom, that's what you do. You devour it, and then you make them adopt your culture. Because Nebi took them boys, which Daniel being one of them, brought them into his service, and what was the first thing Nebuchadnezzar did? Put them to school for years, teaching them the Babylonian customs. Okay, well, that's cool. You know, there's some verses. We can see that, Nolan. That makes sense. What's the point? What did Rome do? Are they out there speaking Roman? Are the Jews even trading necessarily Roman currency? Nope. Guess what the Jews had? They had a shekel. Was that a Roman currency coin? No, the shekel goes back to the Old Testament, man, because that was the accepted coin for the temple. Why do you think there's money changers in the temple courtyard? Why do you think there's money changers? Why are there money changers for Jesus to come and to overturn their tables? Because all these people are coming with their Greek Roman coins, and they're coming down into Jerusalem, and they don't have, oh, we left the shekels at home, you know. And the only accepted currency for the tithe of the temple is the shekel, which is a Hebrew currency. So there's one example. What did the Romans do? The Romans came in and it devoured more than any of the kingdoms before it, geographically. The empire was far reaching than Babylon or Persia or anything that Alexander the Great conquered geographically. And then the Romans came in and said, you must speak our language, you must worship our gods, and you must take our currency. And oh, they didn't, did they? The Jews even had their own king. Well, he was God, right? You ever heard of King Herod? How is there a king when Caesar's king? Now, you guys see in the picture? The Hebrews had their own law, their own language, their own school system, their own currency, their own king. And it was okay as long as you what? Two things. As long as you what? Paid your taxes, and King Caesar is the one true king. If you did those two things, You can keep your little boutique on the corner, and you can speak whatever language you want in that thing, and you can take whatever coin you need, as long as you pay your taxes. And you always confess Caesar is the one true king. Anybody here know why Pontius Pilate even had a job in the first place? Governor. Governor of what? What's he governor of? Why did Pontius, does anybody actually know this? Why did Pontius Pilate even have a job? Okay, so any kind of authority we know is granted because of God. So how did he get this authority? What was his job? Say that out loud. He was an intercessor. The Romans appointed all of these governors all over the kingdom, and their job was to keep the peace. Because when you let people have their own king, their own money, their own language, their own law, their own education, they kind of start to think for themselves, don't they? So they had all of these Roman prefects, stationed all over their empire. And their job was just peacekeeper. That was it. That's why Lorenzo, who did, and he's teaching Sunday school, did such an excellent job on Wednesday night. When them Jews start to say things like, we're not going to follow the Romans anymore in 70 AD, right? It's the governors that are trying to restore the peace. And then they report back to Caesar and say, hey, these ones are getting out of line. Now we got to bring the army. That was their job. Now I'm showing you this because that is very different from Babylon. Babylon came in, killed everybody, because that's what they did to the Jews, right? Burnt everything to the ground, including the temple, because that's what they did in Jerusalem, right? And then, if you weren't too old, Hey, Daniel, come here, buddy. You're good. Look at this young, strapping, strong lad. Good-looking jawline. Hey, you come learn the language of the Chaldeans. And then they enslaved everybody, didn't they? See why maybe the Jews were a little confused when Jesus says, remember when Jesus said, I have come to set you free in John? What did the Jews say? We're not enslaved to anybody. The Roman trick worked, didn't it? Them Jews, alive in Jesus' day, did not think that they were enslaved to the Romans. Jesus is like, well, we could have that discussion, but we'll skip it for the sake of time, and we'll go to the fact that anybody who commits sin is a slave of sin. Right? Them Jews didn't realize who their master was. It was the Romans. How did they not recognize it? They had a lot of liberty, didn't they? Ugh. Probably a little more liberty than any of them Persians had when Alexander the Great came in, right? He comes in and he just kills them all. Guys, physically speaking, Rome is so different from the first three. And that's why it's introduced differently. It's not just a devouring, conquering animal like a bear. It could snap your leg with one clench of its jaw. That wasn't Rome. Rome didn't fight that way. It's not a leopard that could come with wings too, because this leopard's flying, right? It's not going to come in, wake up next morning, the whole town's gone. That wasn't Rome. Rome's introduced as iron in Daniel chapter 2 because although iron had been fashioned into weapons for thousands of years, the Romans were the first one who were able to do it without them being 300 pounds. You guys know that? Iron weapons have been around for a long time, but they were not popular because they were too heavy. And it's the Romans who figured out how to fashion weapons out of iron without making them so heavy. That's why it's called the Iron Roman Army. You ever heard that before? Rome did not conquer because it had great generals like Alexander the Great or great kings. Rome conquered because it had iron and it figured out how to use it. And it destroyed and trampled down everything that was before it. Do you see how good this prophecy is? Okay. But when it conquered its opposition, it did not burn every city to the ground, not all of them. It did not necessarily enslave them and bring them back to their home city and make them build pyramids. They just said, hey, we'll leave you here and you can set up your market and your school and your little mini senates, you know, and your little synagogues, just pay taxes. And that was very different from the rest of the empires that came before it. Now, that's important to understand this, because when God comes in the days of the Romans, the Ancient of Days, and he judges them and takes their dominion and gives it to Jesus, what branches off of that Roman Empire? A horn. And it's that horn that in the days of Jesus and his church is going to continue to wage war with the church until Jesus comes back in final judgment. Do you see that? So what, physically speaking, was already starting to change in how it conquered men? Because who's behind these kingdoms when it comes to conquering God? The devil. Okay? You're already seeing in a physical sense, Rome's kind of changing the way that it conquers and works. Then God judges it, and then this horn snaps off. And then the rest of the vision is this horn doesn't fight the same way that the kingdoms before it fought. It's different. It wages war with the saints and the holy ones, and it utters blasphemous things against God. And that's what I need you to take away from this morning, because that's what we can cover next week, is that horn is the remnant of the Roman Empire, which is the culmination of all earthly power in its wickedness. It's the fullness of it. Okay? It's anti-God agenda. But then that horn snaps off, and it's going to continue to fight against God's people. But that fight looks a lot different than it did in the Old Testament. I think if we have that, you know, we're ready for next week. So thanks for your attention.